When any disaster forces people from their homes, those who survive face the choice of eventually returning or starting anew someplace else. But when the disaster isn't over in a couple of days but lingers for generations, and when your home may not be safe, it's a tough choice. People who live near nuclear power meltdowns in Chernobyl, Ukraine, and Fukushima, Japan, have considered those alternatives, and it's the central question of photojournalist Michael Forster Rothbart's recent book, Would You Stay? Michael, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
So, you spent 2 years living near Chernobyl, and you've also spent a lot of time near Fukushima, Japan. Describe those two regions for us.
It's interesting. If you go into the exclusion zone in Chernobyl or in Fukushima, they actually feel quite similar. There's just a feeling of small farming towns that have been forgotten and then abandoned. But people have this vision of the Chernobyl exclusion zone being a dead zone, and really nothing could be further from the truth. There's a lot of plant life, there's a lot of animal life, and there's actually a lot of people still living and working in the Chernobyl exclusion zone.
Of course, they're not really allowed back in the Fukushima zone yet.
The Japanese government is very eager to try to get people back into the Fukushima zone, and so they've actually designated three different sections of the zone. One section, they're hoping to get people back in as soon as possible, and obviously the more contaminated zones, it could be decades or centuries before people are let back in.
When you look in these areas very close to Chernobyl, it doesn't look like a disaster zone, you say.
If you know what to look for, you can definitely see the signs of radiation. But if I'm just walking through the woods, it looks like a quiet forest anywhere. I spent a lot of time with these biologists who taught me how to see the signs of radiation. For example, pine trees typically have something called apical dominance, which means that the branch that grows the most is the topmost branch and just continues to grow up and up and up. And that's why you get pine trees with a narrow, you know, triangular shape. But because of the radiation, that has stopped. And instead, you get these distorted trees with branches going out in every direction. And they look, you know, more like shrubs than trees. So that's just one simple example. Also, I saw with these biologists, I saw a lot of birds that had minor deformities. And so there's actually an interesting scientific debate that's been going on for years in Chernobyl, because one school of thought says that actually humans are the biggest disruptor to natural life and natural habitat. So if you take the humans out of the equation by creating this exclusion zone, actually the animals do very well. And people in that camp cite there are wolves that have returned to the Chernobyl exclusion zone. There are actually wild horses that were reintroduced there that are doing reasonably well. But the other school of biologists have been doing some very careful studies, bird counts and things like that, and discovered that there are insects and birds and other animals that you'd expect to find there that are not there, and that there's some direct correlation between the level of radiation in a particular spot and what is living there.
Of course, Fukushima's disaster is a lot younger. What were you able to see in the exclusion zones that was, well, different?
When I first went into the Fukushima exclusion zone, I was actually amazed how similar it looked to the Chernobyl exclusion zone. You know, the same little farming villages and a feeling of abandonment. What's different in Japan, I found, first of all, is the scale. Estimates are that Fukushima released between 10 and 30% of the amount of radiation as Chernobyl. And Chernobyl actually contaminated an area of about 56,000 square miles, which is, you know, roughly the size of New York State. Whereas Fukushima, the area it was contaminated is closer to the size of Connecticut, you know, about 4,500 square miles, you know, maybe 10% of the size.
Let's talk about a couple of specific pictures here, Michael. Tell me about Sasha Kupny. He's a Chernobyl plant worker.
Sasha's an interesting character. He's an amateur photographer, and so although he's been working at the Chernobyl plant for decades, his dream really was to take pictures, and so we became friends. Sasha Kupny showed me this photograph that he had taken inside the sarcophagus, basically in the reactor hall. And what's amazing in this picture, if you zoom in on it and look closely, is you see these green, blue, and red dots on the picture. What it's showing is basically radioactive particles hitting the camera sensor during the 1 second exposure. But Sasha described the experience to me. And I said, why are you willing to go in here? And he said to me, have you ever climbed a mountain? Well, you know when you get to that top and you look around and you've realized you've gone as far as a human can go? he said he had that feeling inside the reactor hall.
Now, there's another photo. This one's from Fukushima. And I think it's rather telling. There's a man who's straightening bicycles in a bike rack. Why is he doing that?
One day I came back from being in the Fukushima exclusion zone, and I got back to Fukushima City, and right outside the train station, there's a man straightening bikes, and I watched him for a while, and I talked to him. I discovered that this is his job, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, is basically to take bikes that people park and line them up. You know, he measures them out with his feet, you know, so they're all about 12 inches apart, and he just goes down the line and makes them all parallel and neat. And I couldn't help thinking, why, when there's so many needs for so many people, would you be spending government money, municipal money, to pay someone to straighten bikes? And I think the answer is that people have a really strong desire for normality. So even when there's chaos around you, perhaps even more when there's chaos around you, you just want some things to be normal. You know, and in this country, you know, we wouldn't care. A chaotic bike rack, we wouldn't even notice it. But in Japan, which is a very culturally orderly society, people do notice that the bikes are in disarray, and that disturbs them. And so it's worth it to them to pay somebody to continue to straighten them.
So how does the culture of Japan compare to the culture of the Ukraine in terms of how people have reacted to these nuclear disasters at the time and following them?
To make some broad generalizations about culture, I'd say that Ukrainians stereotypically are this pessimistic culture, you know, that things are terrible and they're never going to get better, and so let's just share another bottle of vodka.
And complain, huh?
And complain all the time, of course. And if you don't have a good complaint, then you have to think one up. Whereas in Japan, I learned this word called gaman, which translates sort of loosely as stoicism, but it's much deeper than that. It's sort of taking pride in being able to survive any situation, and very specifically not to complain, not to show people that you're struggling, to continue living and doing the best you can and going on no matter what the circumstances are. It's interesting now, the state government, the prefecture government in Fukushima is really pushing people to downplay the consequences of radiation and to say, you know, life goes on, things are fine, let's promote our city, let's promote our prefecture and encourage tourism to come back. Because there's this social pressure not to complain and not to talk about your fears, people are very closed-mouthed. You have to get to know people pretty well before they really start to open up and talk about what they're afraid of.
Now that the government is saying, well, you can't quite move back to the way that we thought you could, how are people reacting? How do you think they're going to react to that news?
Once people lose faith in their government, it's really hard to regain it. And I heard this over and over again in Japan, that people said, we trusted the government, and they let us down. They lied to us, they misinformed us, they weren't there to help us. So people have lost faith. And I think this latest news that people who they were promising would be able to return may not be able to return is just another nail in the coffin. Like 9/11 in this country, the Fukushima disaster was a watershed moment for Japan, where everything changes. And I think decades from now, looking back, people say nothing was ever the same after Fukushima.
So why do you suppose that some people stay and others go? What's the typical answer that people would give you when you ask them why they were staying in places like right near Chernobyl?
I really found two things. One is that people replied to me and said, well, why should we leave? It's hard for us to understand it. We live in such a transient world in this country. We're so mobile, moving every couple of years. But if you live in the same house as your ancestors, it takes a lot to uproot you. I talked to some old woman, for example, who said, okay, we've been through the Nazis, we've been through a famine, we've been through changes in government, and all these terrible things have happened to us in the past. We're not going to leave just because of some invisible radiation. And I think the most basic reason is just because this is home, and home is such an important notion to people. You know, people suffer great difficulties in order to stay in their home.
Michael Forster Rothbart's book is called Would You Stay? Thanks so much, Michael.
It's great talking with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.